Welcome back to Toys on Tap. This week is huge as we bring on, honestly, one of the coolest people Toys on Tap has had the pleasure of meeting, Paul Kaiju. Paul Copeland comes on, and this is episode 1 of 3, walking through his life, early career, and Sifubi toy making, and what that looks like for the entirety of the soft vinyl or Sifubi toy scene. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can like, follow, rate, review wherever you get podcasts. It's free for you. It means the world to us. If you want to jump on and follow us on all socials at Toys on Tap, it's a good way to stay in contact. It's a good way to find out what we've got going on, all the good stuff, drops, the toys that we make, Kickstarter, all that good stuff. And if you want to support the show even more, you can follow us on patreon.com/toysontap. It is going to be under renovation soon because I want to kind of change how we do things, but it's where you get extra episodes, nitty gritty, tapped in, behind the shelf or beyond the shelf, all kinds of cool things. Now let's get to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. All right, are you ready to jump in?
Yeah, let's do this.
Okay. So, just like every episode before we start, please, please introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yes, sir. My name is Paul Copeland, known as Paul Kaiju. I'm a Sifubi toy maker. I've been doing so for probably, 18 years. I don't really think about it much because I'm still doing it. And that's about it. I'm in sunny San Diego, and I've moved here from Long Beach, California, and I picked everything up in a U-Haul and moved here. I was in a relationship with my current girlfriend, Melissa, and she said, move here and make toys. So that's what I did.
The dream.
Sounds kind of simple, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we're splitting this over 3 episodes, so we get to kind of dive into who you are, where you kind of started, which I'm really excited for, because if it has anything to do with what you now create, it's a good story. Yeah. So walk me all the way back. I want to hear young Paul. He's a little kid. What are the toys we're playing with, the cartoons we're watching, that kind of stuff?
Oh, man. Oh, yeah, I'd say people around my age, Gen X, I think we grew up in really groovy, perfect time for cultural nerdity. You know, I think we grew up with Saturday morning cartoons, the best toys ever made. I mean, dangerous toys that use electricity. You know, it was kind of a test. If you survived playing with thing makers and plug-in toys and didn't take them to the bathtub, you're okay. You're going to make it, you know?
Yeah.
So we had Saturday morning, you know, TV and hang out with all the cousins or local neighbors and watch this stuff. And, you know, of course, back, we lived in Chicago back in the 70s, and you know, every Saturday, every morning was Speed Racer, like all that, Kimba. Yeah. And not only I watched it, but my dad would watch it with me. And he liked it too. And he always had his eye on crazy stuff on the, we had a little black and white TV. And he was always finding cool stuff and going, hey, come here. You know, he would actually get me involved and have me sit down and watch. You know, and I think I saw my first Godzilla movie when he actually had his camera set up in front of the TV, and he was taking stills. And I was like, and he goes, come here, you got to watch this. And it was Son of Godzilla. Yeah. And it was me, the scene where she's feeding Minya the coconuts. Like, and I was like, I don't know what this is, but I was mesmerized.
Yeah.
So that was like, you know, the first Godzilla movie, and my dad would make up weird names for the monsters because he didn't know them, like Gigantus Mantis for the Kamakura and stuff like that. But it's like, I found out later, that's not what they were called, but I always kind of went by my dad's names for things. And he was a scale model builder, always building planes and tanks and he would do scratch built stuff. So I was brought up in a very creative environment. My parents were the type of people that if they couldn't get something, they made it, like anything. My parents decided instead of getting a new couch, they learned how to reupholster and spent a weekend upholstering our couch. I came home and it was just looked like a new couch. And it's like, they just reupholstered it. So I was pretty much driven by that. If you want something, you have to do it. You do it yourself. Mm-hmm. You learn how to do it, you know. But anyway, as far as like, you know, the toys at the time in the late 60s, early 70s, we had Mattel was at their tip top. All the companies like Remco, there was so many toys, your head would spin.
Yeah.
And I always saw kids bringing their toys to school and like Outer Space Man and stuff like that. And I'd be like, where'd you get that? You know, and I give me that. Where'd you get that? And, you know, at the time you could buy stuff like that at like markets. Markets had big toy sections in there. But if you saw a toy you wanted, good luck, unless you went to the store with your parents and cried a lot and you'd get it.
What up, toy nerds? This is Ray.
And Dave, go check out our brand new YouTube channel, The Toy Rats.
We make toys.
We talk about toys.
We talk about old toys.
And new toys.
And toys that we make.
And we're just a bunch of goofballs. It's a good time.
We make fun of Dave a lot.
I'm all right with that. So, if you get a chance, go check out Toy Rats on YouTube. You won't be disappointed. You might be.
Yeah, you could. Who knows?
You got to check it out.
Toy Rats. Toy Rats. YouTube.
Bye.
But there was just a lot of crazy stuff. And there was little independent, small, like, toy kind of distribution companies. And there was also a company called, what were they called? MPC, Plastic Dinosaurs. I had buckets of them. You know, I think I had a rubber alligator that was my Godzilla because I couldn't find a real Godzilla toy. Nobody made them till Imperial way later. So there was a lot of cool stuff. Then we had a store called Bargain Town, which was a version of Toys R Us. Yeah. So if I was really good, you know, my dad goes, I'll take, if I dove off a diving board, he'd promise me, I'm going to take you to Bargain Town. And he wouldn't.
Yeah. In true dad fashion.
Yeah. And there was also multiple toy makers. I'm just trying to remember the names of all these companies.
Yeah.
You know, that existed during the time. And they made a lot of cool stuff. Some of it didn't work so great.
Yeah.
It was all meant to just throw away. You know,
yeah, this is like the season of rack toys, it feels like.
Yeah, rack toys, big racks full of toys.
You had the same, it's funny to hear you describe the upholstery, like if you didn't have it, you made it, because then in your toys, you didn't have a Godzilla toy, so something else became that toy. And so you were just living that out without even knowing it in toys.
Yeah, I was, you know, and we also had, you know, they're very popular now, but we had Lego, and Lego weren't so sophisticated.
Yeah.
You know, they were just blocks and flat, and I'd make stuff out of that or make stuff out of clay, you know, always something to make. If I was bored, my parents would be like, there's no reason for you to be bored. You got a lot to do.
So in the current, like me growing up, we had game systems that started coming out in the 90s. So we got to a point where toys just fell to the wayside, got thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
But in this era, it seems like toys, there was nothing really to gravitate towards, except we find either we are attracted to women or we want a car or like something like that.
That's so, what happened. That's you know what? It happened to my generation too.
Okay.
It's like, I don't want anyone seeing me playing with toys. You know, we had the Atari and the Commodore. We had all these new computer consoles and systems. You know, we were kind of nerdy. You know, we wanted to play with that stuff. So we kind of put the toys aside. I remember doing that. You want to go out and learn what it's like to be an adult. You know, you want to go explore a little bit. You're going to have to put that stuff aside and, you know, go out there and work it. It happened in my generation too.
That's so crazy. Looking back, it's so bizarre that those game systems were the things that got us away from toys. They weren't great game systems. They were just new.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I still have an Odyssey 2. I still have my Atari 2600s, know, and there's a pretty big following still for there's homebrew games. People are still making stuff for that. You know, I recently recapped one of my 2600s and gave it a composite out just to see if it would work. And, you know, everyone's like, why are you doing that? You can get an emulator. And yeah. I'm like, nothing's like this. The hardware, you know, this is nothing like it.
Yeah.
So
we have the like an emulator version that Nintendo had made of one of the old systems. And there's nothing like having to pull the game out and blowing in it to get it to work. I miss that so much.
You know, that didn't really work, right?
Ah, don't tell me that, Paul.
That just meant you had to take your Nintendo apart and replace the slot. The contact slot, which I had to do too.
You dismantled my whole childhood all at once.
The blow is not real.
Yeah. Oh no.
Keep doing it if it makes you happy.
Now, because you said that, I'm doing it to everything that's electronic. My phone. We start to get rid of these toys, and we start to, like, as you get a little older, what are we transitioning to? And what does that kind of do for you in high school or middle school era?
Oh, okay. Good question. You know, I collected Japanese toys because I discovered these little shops in Little Tokyo and Orange County that imported toys. Mm-hmm. And I would have my parents drive me out. If I had a friend who was into them, their parents would drive us there. And with the amount of money, you had to figure out what to get. And it was hard. And, you know, I would buy stuff, keep it in the box. Every time I'd go, my dad would go, he'd go, get that one. That one's die cast. That one, don't get that vinyl toy. That's crap.
Yeah.
You know? So I got a lot of toys and I'd get them and take them out. And some of them I'd play with till they broke and some I would put away. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the boxes were so nice and the packaging and all the little, they would have, you know, the little smaller toys hanging on boards. You could pluck those off and play, you know, those were to play with. And, but it was just, you know, I amassed a little treasure chest of Japanese diecasts. And I had, of course, Dinky toys, you know, Dinky toys were awesome. Corgi toys, but the Japanese toys were weird. You know, they were, and you never saw the show. Like,
yeah,
we did get access to some shows on UHF, but a lot of these shows, and you also learned to translate Japanese because you wanted to know the name of this character, this vehicle. So it kind of got you on this, you know, culturally enlightening education, you know, which that's how I started on that path, you know.
Yeah. I'm going to give my wife your number and so you can tell her how educational all my toys are.
Everything's got a story to it, you know, and even if you can't read it, you learn to read it and understand it a little bit, you know. Yeah. Now we have Google Translate. You can just aim it at a foot and translate the name.
Yeah, it's so unfair. You guys did all the legwork so that we can really run now. I lived in Orange County for probably 10 years, never once went to Little Tokyo. So I missed out, I think, horribly.
A lot of that stuff was gone.
Okay.
By the 80s. And by that time, toys had changed. A lot more plastic, a lot less die-cast. The characters, you know, the robots became more vehicles than characters, like Gundam. And by the time I'd returned to it after taking a break to go be punk rock ladies man artist, I went back and I'm like, the toys have all changed.
Yeah.
You know, they're all different. They're still cool, but they're not quite the same, you know?
Yeah. I think what's interesting is I find myself attracted. I mean, I have all these soft vinyl toys and a bunch of toys, and I find myself attracted to the weird, which I think stems from that era. Because, like, you have characters like Conigon, who is a character that just eats coins. That's all he has.
Yeah, he's money man.
Yeah, and that is such a crazy thing to want. And I have a bunch of them because I love them.
And the sculpt is, you know, it's very bottom heavy.
Yeah.
And the sculpt is beautiful. It's classic,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like the Godzilla, the first Godzilla Mara-san doesn't look anything like Godzilla.
No.
Don't look at anything, but it's cool. It's iconic now.
Yeah.
But as far as I'm concerned, it's Godzilla now.
Yeah. <know? laughs> With all the influence of your dad saying, hey, buy this, buy that. Did you buy a like at least one vinyl figure then?
I'd sneak in a vinyl. They were cheap.
Which one did you buy? Do you remember?
I was around the time Bullmark was kind of finishing up and they were doing Ultraman Leo, which are very valuable now. They did five, and those would appear, and I would grab those. I still have them in my case. I still have them to this day. And I also saw some stuff I should have got. Can I remember it? There was like a base that came with all the Godzilla minis, and it was on a header card, a bubble, or a blister card.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that is just so weird. I just don't know if I like it or not. It had a little missile launching base and had the minis of Godzilla. Here, can you hold on?
Yeah.
So you had this base.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It shot a missile and these bend out. And it's vinyl. It's softy.
Mm.
And they released a couple sets. I have the Mach Baron set that came with this base. But they also made one with Godzilla minis. And the minis... the whole set's worth a lot of money and incredibly hard to find. But anyway, one of the things I passed on, and, you know, I probably would have ripped it out of the blister anyway and played with it, but I'd probably still have it because I still have a lot of my toys.
That is insane. Like we always talk to artists, and it's the story really comes down to we had toys, we loved them, we got rid of them. But to have toys, to love them, and I'm assuming it was your parents that kind of stored them for you, or was it you that kind of didn't want to throw them away?
I stored them.
Okay.
You know, a lot of the American toys, Matt Mason, they lost their heads. Yeah. G.I. Joe's got buried in the yard.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. But the Japanese, like Poppy and Bullmark toys, didn't do that with them. But, you know, I did have friends that would collect too, and they would take one vinyl and take it outside and we'd shoot it with BB guns. You know, who didn't? Or blow it up with firecrackers. You know, we were terrible. Some of the stuff we blew up. I don't even want to say.
Yeah. So as you high school, you transition into away from toys and stuff. What are we getting into? Is it women? Is it band? Is it skateboard? Like, where are we at?
You know, I was a skateboarder in the 70s.
Okay.
And I pretty much put toys aside to go skate. You know, I'd go to all the skate parks. And then probably after that, it was the punk scene.
Yeah.
And trying to find like-minded friends in the punk scene. And, you know, because the art, to me, it was about the art. The music was great. The energy was great. But in Long Beach, we had kind of a weird scene. We had like a lot of the wealthy kids, like which we called, you know, jock punks.
Yeah.
And we were like the middle class kind of scum, you mm-hmm. know? So I eventually ended up hanging out with punks from Bellflower and Lakewood who, you know, they didn't have that circle over there. And, and I felt a little safer. And plus I met a guy in ROP graphic design class. And we were very much the same. His name was Gary, and we were same age, but we were both geek punks. You know, we were into sci-fi and into Wall of Voodoo at the same time, you know, and it was strange at the time. That's what really brought us together. We were like, yeah, I like, you know, I like Devo and I like Space 1999, you know? And he was also an artist. So we would sketch, draw stuff and pass it across the tables to each other and do exquisite corpses. He would draw one half and I would draw the other half. And that was pretty much moving on from there. You know, I wanted to be more involved in the art, and he did flyers. I think he did a couple album covers. I wanted to do comics, and I ended up doing a comic with a friend that got left on a bus bench and lost forever. You know, it was just hit or miss. And I was in high school, I was in print shop in the morning, first and second period. And we would print, and silk, I learned to silk screen. Mm-hmm. And we would silk screen, you know, shirts with skulls on them. And the teacher was like, you know, it's okay for now.
Yeah.
And then everyone saw what I was doing. And the next year, everyone started taking the print class, wanting to print punk shirts, and the teacher was like, okay, this has to stop, you know.
What a cool, like, experience.
We can't have this imagery.
Yeah. So we're talking graphic design and print shop all happening, and you, yeah, like emboldening you in this art career. So is this building this like love for art, or are you still in the art of like, I want to be in the punk scene?
I wanted to know how to do a little bit of everything. Okay. You know, I played a bass. I had friends in Orange County I'd go jam with. We had a band, and you know, I never really got to go play shows or anything, but I used to go to all the gigs, Olympic Auditorium, LA, yeah, Hollywood, you know, and I wasn't even 21 yet. It's like, I don't know how I got into some places, but we managed.
Yeah.
So, and then after a while, the punk scene got a little ugly, I thought, after this kind of, how do I explain it? This kind of gang kind of, and I, after that, I was kind of done. I'm, yeah, like, you know, I'd been to a couple shows where there was a pretty bad brawls, and I was like, this is not what I'm here for, mm-hmm, you know? So I moved on from there until later, when, you know, post-punk and shoegaze and all that stuff, I was waiting for that, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what happened with that. But, you know, it was 2 years in print shop. I was basically working in high school, printing notepads for the staff and stuff like that.
That's amazing. As you are doing this, does this start to inform you of what you want to do after you graduate?
Heck no. Oh, I was in the 13th grade after high school. I went to City College and took astronomy and fencing. And I did take a couple art classes, and the teachers, you know, I by that time I got a job in aerospace. But anyway, you know, I tried the 13th grade for a while, and I was more into the partying,
yeah, stuff.
You know, I made all these new friends. You know, you make all these new friends, and it's, you're starting to try to be an adult, but you're just taking advantage of things you can as an adult, like drinking and,
yeah,
you know, all this kind of bad, you know, I call it the 13th grade.
Yeah.
So that went on for a while, but I got to see a lot of great shows and meet a lot of great people.
Yeah, let's talk about the aerospace thing, because that is a crazy thing to drop. You tell me about that. You worked in that field?
Well, after failing the 13th grade,
yeah,
my dad goes, you better think of something or else you're going to join the military. And I was, yeah, like, nah, I'm not doing that. So I was talking with a friend, and he goes, look, I got an in to this trade school that immediately got you hired into McDonnell Douglas, which was in Long Beach. Mm-hmm. And he goes, yeah, it's 6 weeks and at night. And I did it. And we all got hired in because the factory was planning on gunning up production. So they were looking for people.
Okay.
So I got hired in, and I was there for 15 years till Boeing bought us out and closed. And from there, I went on to other things.
That is such a radical change from the punk scene into professional America.
Well, we were gunning out 3 planes a week. It was crazy.
Yeah.
It was all drilling and riveting and partying. You know, I didn't really have time to do hobbies, but during that time I had met a friend named Kim Ito, and he was a super sculptor. I'd met him. I still went to shows. I still went to the Shrine Auditorium. Mm-hmm. I went to, it was called Mad Model Party in the 80s. And it was all resin model kits and monster kits and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go to that, and I met this guy. He had Billikens. Billikens are these vinyl model kits that they were making. Kind of hard to get, but his prices were like $30. They go for a lot more now.
Yeah.
But I used to buy Billikens off him, and he was a resin caster, and he's a super sculptor. He sculpts mostly Bruce Lee. And he did a wow. figure of Kato from the Green Hornet. And he asked me if I wanted to go over to his studio in downtown LA, and he'd show me how to do resin casting. So I would go over there and watch him, you know, make the molds and cast the resin. And eventually it got to the point I would help him paint store displays for the show the next day. We would paint model kits all night and go to the show in the morning and stuff. So that was kind of my first introduction to conventions.
So what year are we talking when we are resin casting? So getting the model kits, I feel like model kits have been around forever. Resin casting, that's really early on. What year are we talking?
I'd say around 88, 89 into the 90s.
Okay. Yeah. I'm always interested in specifically resin casting because I had found a toy that Steven Hillenburg and another person resin cast and sold something like 2,000 of them. And it started in 89. So it's like, that's an early time. Yeah.
And yeah, the technology in the resin was just one color.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like now, you know, you can tint your resins and the clear resins. The smooth on revolution, you know, but
we'll
talk about that later. But back then it was just that mustard colored 2-part AB and, you know, the silicone molds. So I helped him out. He really showed me how to do all that. And he sculpted with a volcanic ash clay.
Okay.
And it was long and tedious, and he'd, you know, a lot of sanding, carving, but he used that. And I found it very difficult to use. And I eventually learned Sculpey firm, and Sculpey was easier for me, you know, but he used that ash clay, which I thought was amazing. I mean, that was real sculpting, you know, to have to learn how to something to dry like that and sand it, you know. But from him, I learned sculpting and carving and sanding all should go together.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of taught me that instead of just sculpting.
Yeah.
You want to finish it and then work it, sculpt it, or, you know, chisel at it and bring it down to where you want it. But he taught me that.
Which now informs your toy making. Correct?
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah, so I probably do more.
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this. Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet. Oh my, we're doomed. Wait, salvation. Hooray, we're saved, DOV2. Limited edition custom artist-made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures. DKE.
Once the form is there, I probably do more sanding and carving. But then you have to, the trick about vinyl is you have to keep the form so it can be pulled. No yeah. undercuts, no weird shapes, things jutting off, you know. I've been pretty lucky. I've maybe had two projects that had to be, I had to resculpt the part because it was just not pullable.
Yeah. There was a factory that I had, because I helped people get theirs done. And there was one that had said, they had said something like, either you can resculpt this and it's two parts, or you keep it how it is and it's seven parts because each piece now has to be.
And every angle has to be. Yeah.
And I was like, no, yeah, we're going to resculpt. I'm so sorry.
Bring the arms up into flying position because yeah. you can't pull them when they're down. And stuff like that.
With doing that stuff and working in the company that you're working for and doing all that, tell me about what's reawakening in you, because you're watching him sculpt and sand and do these things. You love toys. So mm-hmm. what's kind of happening in you? Is there this awakening like, oh, I can do this?
Well, it didn't really happen until he introduced me to Yuji and Michi from M1 Go. And they were the first to kind of revive the vinyl. They yeah. were doing ultra characters that didn't exist. And they did Kim Urgent. I remember Kim had a couple of them. And I'm like, what are these? They look like the bull marks I used to collect.
Yeah.
And he introduced me to them. And I was like, well, if they can do that, maybe I can do it too.
Okay.
So I was more into the idea of doing a vinyl monster toy a long time ago, but I just didn't know how to approach it, you know, or who, if it could possibly be done for me. I thought they were relying on huge factories somewhere to do it. I didn't know they were like in-house small factories in Japan that did it, because, you know, I really wanted to go to Japan in the 90s, but I was just so preoccupied with so much other stuff that I didn't get to go. And I wish I would have, but I made up for it now. So
yeah.
But M1 really kind of showed me that it can be done. It's still being done. I was like, I thought maybe these vinyl factories were all gone, you know, but they're still there. They're making other things. They're making pachinko machine parts and fishing lures and, you know, so that's what really kind of ignited the fire in my head. And it wasn't till I was out of aerospace that I started sculpting seriously to get something made. And whether it be resin or plastic or anything. And it wasn't until later that I learned, and I went to Japan and was introduced to some people to help me do that.
Yeah. That's you're meeting some of the most crazy people early on. M1 Go people early on is insane.
Yeah.
Do you just chalk this up to being in the right place at the right time?
Right place, right time. Okay. I was the guy where I got my name was Funihara from Astro Zombies. I used to hang out with all those guys.
Yeah.
Danny Sirocco and great guys. I was kind of like, you know, the little hangout guy, and they were all into Universal Monsters and all this, you know, a lot of things, but they were mostly into Creature of the Black Lagoon. And I was really into the Japanese kaiju, like, you know, so yeah. they called me Kaiju Paul. So I used that later and just reversed it to Paul Kaiju.
Yeah.
So it's really those guys gave me that name because, but I kind of regret it because, man, they got some cool stuff. I got to meet some cool people. We got to go to Bob Burns' house. Just insane. Some of the stuff I've seen, I can't even explain like some of the props I've actually touched.
Yeah.
From Alien, from just the Thing. It's just nuts, dude.
Insane.
It's really nuts.
What's crazy, I mean, this is chalk it up to my naivete. When I first started encountering the soft vinyl scene, you hear the name Paul Kaiju, and my initial thought was, with a name like Kaiju, you have to be a vinyl puller. I thinking it was your real last name. Thinking that, yes, I don't know what was going on. Yeah, there's
people that do.
Yeah, which is crazy. There's that middle ground before, which I kind of think will be the end of this episode, at least. The middle ground between the aerospace era and the actual toy production era, where you're doing this decision process of, what am I going to do? And then you start this. So walk me through that. Talk to me about the, I mean, you kind of stop at this place because Boeing comes in.
Yeah.
And so
they closed.
Yeah. So you immediately like start sculpting, thinking this is going to be your job, or what are we doing in that?
I just pretty much, I did take a test that to show where I could be placed. I did some job placement, and I got a job at a refinery doing AutoCAD.
Awesome.
Which for 5 years, and it was not a bad job. Mm-hmm. I didn't like going out and walking around in the refinery because it was a scary, dangerous place. But
yeah,
they were starting to make me do that more and more. And then they ended the contract with our company. And I showed up on a Friday and couldn't get through the gate. And they were like, the guard was like, let me call your office. Cause we had an offsite office. And he goes, I'm sorry, you don't have a job here anymore.
Crazy.
So before that, I was doing some resin casting, but it was mostly reproduction doll parts.
Okay.
Eyeballs. I was doing Blythe eyeballs. I was doing custom painting on doll faces because airbrush is a little trick, you know. And Melissa and I, we had a little team named Team Sibley, and we actually entered a couple contests, and we won one beauty contest with our doll that was actually produced by Takara.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, she was produced by Takara. So I spent most of my time on that side. You know, of course, there was a resin ball joint dolls, which I hear resin. I mean, that's pretty cool. You can do that. So I was making the eye chips. I was making like glow in the dark. I learned how to cast those. And I made money for a while doing that. And then I got the job at the refinery and started working there. And then during that time, I was hit up by Super 7 to do Party Ball, which was my first vinyl toy. And Gargamel sculpted it.
Yeah. How did Super 7 know about you?
We were all in the same community because the toy community was so small.
Okay, so Brian knew who you were.
Brian knew. Brian and I talk a lot about toys and stuff. We were all in the... We all came from the collecting community.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, oh, well, we all want to be punk rock and make toys now. It's like, you know, okay. But he did this line called Monster Family, and it was a line of small figures. And he asked me to do one. So I was kind of like, sign me up.
Yeah.
You know, so while I was at the refinery, I was over in the corner drawing my character, which was Party Ball.
Wow.
And you know, during that time, I think I was just painting squeak toys. Mm-hmm. I didn't even really have a toy. I would just get blank squeak toys and paint veins and make them look weird. And I was selling them at Designer Con at the time and everything. And then I started to network on the internet with Japanese makers and started doing runs of their toys, like Mori from Real Head and Exohead and Zolman, just got maker after maker, and he's sold them here under with raffles.
Yeah.
And you know, so I really got a lot of good, and Gargamel and all these companies were making blanks, so people were sending me the blanks to customize and paying me for it.
That is so cool.
Yeah, that's kind of kind of through the back door. I started more painting toys than actually sculpting them. And then eventually got the fire lit under me to start sculpting.
Yeah.
And then I sculpted Boss Carrion, which was my first.
Yeah, I think that's going to be – this is a good way to end this episode because the whole next episode is just the early career and okay. what that looks like. And I think that you
– Empire of Blister.
Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 3.75 inch or 1/18. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available.
Empire Blisters.
Now sponsor Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's TOYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters. Empire Blisters.
Man, the hard part is like I just want to draw more out of you because we've already started the conversation.
No, it's great talking about. I remember stuff too.
Yeah, and it's crazy.
The timeline, you know.
Yeah,
the whole timeline.
So next episode will definitely be about that. So I'm excited about hearing about that. The last part of each episode, Paul, is you get to plug away. I mean, we have a run of three episodes. So each episode you get to plug sales or drops or whatever you got going on. You had a drop of the – man, the dolphin things are so insane.
Oh, I'm glad you liked them. I love Iruka Gundam.
They are I don't know how to tell you how insane or how pumped I was to look at them and to have them in my shelf. But if you have drops coming up, please, please share here or how they can get in touch with you if they need to get in touch with you, all that stuff.
Let me look up something really quick because I have Buona Spoons has at Grass Hut has a Gam Jam coming up. And he does it every year. And my new figure, Chuto will premiere. I did three one-off hand paints for Gam Jam. And that's the first time. But I have a run of Chuto's probably coming out in a couple weeks.
Okay.
But right now, I just did, you know, it's kind of funny when I get a new figure, I need kind of a honeymoon period with it where... I learn what the paint possibilities are.
Yeah.
So if there's a show at the time, it's good timing. I can paint a figure and send it to that. So we have my friend Buona Spoons, who's having Gam Jam. Oh, where's the date, dude?
October 4th.
Yeah. October 4th. Thank you. October 4th at Lloyd Mall for Grass Hut. But look up Buona Spoons on Instagram and you'll find more information. He's going to have a lot of really nice stuff at that show.
Awesome. That's amazing. And we will let this episode come out on Monday then because it needs to come up before then.
Okay. And then, right now I'm just working on prototype for new figures. And once I get that color dialed in and all my headers in the mail, then we'll be ready to go for sales. But if you're interested in my stuff, follow me on Paul Kaiju at Instagram. And I always say when I'm going to have a shop drop, I always say what's coming up and previews. You just have to follow me on there and you'll catch a shop drop very soon.
Amazing. Paul, thank you so much for coming on Toys on
Tap.
Thank you,
Abraham. It was great to talk to you and it was nice to meet you. And thanks for coming out for SummerSlam again.